Well, today I want to explain where this idea of a generalized complex manifold came from. Because it came, as far as I'm concerned, from a rather natural source, which, if you look at more closely, you see other structures emerging from, structures which are still related to this orthogonal structure on T plus T star. So when I started, I pointed out that we should be thinking of a manifold with the tangent bundle replaced by T plus T star. And I've been talking mainly so far about a particular type of complex of geometrical structure, this generalized complex structure. But I want to show that there are other types of structure which are also interesting, and that some of them arise in this, from this same source. So, so this is related to something I wrote a paper on a few years ago. But really, it was a problem which I wanted to see from a basic, pure mathematical point of view. The fact, the well-known fact, that if you have a three-dimensional Calabi-Yau manifold, so we have the holomorphic three-form omega, then if we take the cohomology class of the real part of omega, so this is a real cohomology class, then this is essentially a modulus, so this is a local modulus for the complex structure on the Calabi-Yau, well, gauged complex structure, complex structure and a choice of holomorphic three-form. So these are the flat coordinates on the moduli space of Calabi-Yau complex structures, which I always found were a bit more mysterious, quite mysterious. So what I wanted to do was to try and view it not from the point of view of coming down from a complex structure to a Calabi-Yau, but of starting with a degree 3 real cohomology class and working backwards to the Calabi-Yau structure. So I want to say, you know, given the cohomology class, how do you find the Calabi-Yau structure that corresponds to it? So the starting point for that was to think of, well, what about the forms which represent this cohomology class? Suppose I take the real part of a holomorphic three-form. What's so special about that, that three-form? And the answer is that as far as linear algebra is concerned, there's nothing special about it. So this is rather a particular feature of six real dimensions. So what do I mean by that? Well, I mean this, that suppose I have, I look at the V, say, so real six-dimensional vector space acted on by the general linear group, then I want to look at the action, the induced action of the general linear group on the, if you like, on the three forms. And the feature that, the special feature of six dimensions that one has is that this has an open orbit. So this is a, well, let's calculate the dimensions. What's the dimension of this, of course, is this is 6 times 5 times 4 over 1 times 2 times 3. This is 20-dimensional. Is that right? Yeah. This is 36-dimensional. So if we know that it has an open orbit, then the stabilizer, the dimension of the stabilizer, is equal to 36 minus 20 is equal to 16. And what the stabilizer is actually, well, it all depends, actually. There are, in fact, different open orbits. But there's one particular open orbit where the stabilizer is SL3C. Okay, so this is an 8-dimensional complex Lie group, and therefore a 16-dimensional real group. So what this says is that actually, if I choose, so let me call this open orbit, let me put a zero in one of my papers. I call these stable forms, but I don't want to push that particular word at the moment. So if I have an element in this vector space, in this open set, then somehow or other, algebraically, it defines me on the vector space V all the structure which is invariant under SL3C. In other words, it defines a complex structure and a complex 3-form, because SL3C is the group that preserves complex structure and the complex 3-form. So all I started with here was a real 3-form, but somehow or other, by some miraculous process, it determines this all this extra structure. Well, you can write out what that is explicitly, but I don't want to do that here. So the point is that SL3C, then, it leaves fixed the complex structure and a complex 3-form, a 3-0 form, if you like. And the relationship between rho and omega is that rho is equal to the real part of omega. So that's what I mean by saying that actually, from the linear algebra point of view, then there is nothing special about the real part of a holomorphic 3-form, that at each point it's just a form in this open set. Well, so this tells us that actually this open set has some rather interesting intrinsic geometry. But in particular, what it says is that, okay, so we start with rho. This is its stabilizer. It determines us these things. And so, in particular, it also determines us the imaginary part of omega. So out of rho, we also get another 3-form, which is the imaginary part. But for the moment, we'll see that appear in a slightly different form in a minute. But for the moment, I want to think that rho determines big omega here. And that determines, I can take omega wedge, omega bar. I, then, what is this? This is an element in the top degree. This is a top degree form on this six-dimensional vector space. So again, there's an algebraic way of getting a scalar, not quite a function, but a scalar with values in this one-dimensional space, algebraically in terms of a 3-form, so long as that 3-form is in this open set. As I say, you can write down tensorial expressions for this if you want, but even in this case, it's not very pretty, and in the cases that I'll be talking about a little later, it's definitely not advisable to do it. Far better to determine, to talk about the structures which are preserved by the stabilizer. So the picture we get here, then, is that we have this vector, well, this open set in a vector space, and we have a function from this with values in this one-dimensional vector space here. And everything I've described is invariant. So this is invariant under the general linear group, or equivariant, I suppose, because it acts non-trivially on this side. So this is some non-linear algebraic function. And, well, one thing that you can say about it is of course, that if you look at the scalars in here, then look at the equivariance says that phi times, say, lambda cubed rho is equal to the natural action on this, which is lambda sixth phi of rho. So in this particular case, this function is homogeneous of degree 2. Okay, so this particular. Sorry? Well, phi is a 3-form, the square is 0. Well, I mean, so Sorry, where, I don't understand. This is a function from some 20-dimensional space into this one-dimensional space. And it's homogeneous. I mean, its equivariance means that in particular it's homogeneous to degree 2. But it's not, when I say algebraic, if you like, it involves square roots and, you know, I mean, it's not a quadratic. Maybe that was the mistake. Okay, so we can now, this is smooth, we can differentiate it. So if you differentiate it, then you get at some point, a linear map. So at rho, I suppose, you get a linear map from this into the top degree. But any linear map from 3 forms to 6 forms is given by the wedge product with a complementary form. So we could say that the derivative of phi applied to a 3 form is equal to rho hat wedge rho dot for some other 3 form rho hat. So this rho hat is another 3 form which is naturally, maybe not miraculously, but naturally determined by rho. And this 3 form turns out to be the imaginary part of omega. So omega is equal to rho plus I rho hat. So I'm doing it in this formal way here because rather than spelling it out in terms of indices, because we're going to use this several times over in different situations. And the same argument will hold. So this is the way in which you go from a, if you like, a generic, or at least a point in this open set, a 3-form in this open set, to a complex 3-form, which is, as a 3-form, it's locally decomposable, and in particular, we can think of that as the 3-form fixed by the stabilizer SL3C. Well, that's just linear algebra. So now let's see what happens on a 6-dimensional manifold. If we work over the complex numbers, yes. And the real numbers, you get different components. There are different real forms of. In this case, actually, the other you get SL3R cross SL3R is the other one. But in some of the other cases we'll be talking about, there are more open sets. So over the complex numbers, then all of these things are dense open orbits, Zariski dense. Later on, I'll mention a reference for the whole problem, which is called pre-homogeneous vector spaces. Okay, so now suppose we now put this linear algebra on the manifold. So suppose I have a 6-dimensional compact manifold. And suppose I have now a form, a 3-form, different use of omega, afraid, never mind. A 3-form such that at each point it lies in this open set. Then I can apply at each this, so this function gives me a volume form at each point, so I can integrate. So I can look at a total volume of rho, which is the integral over m of phi of rho. So this is a diffeomorphism invariant volume associated to the 3-form rho. Okay, and maybe I should have said this, that you want to know what it is. So actually, you see, if I take rho dot here to be rho, in other words, if I vary in the radial direction, then because I know that phi is homogeneous, a degree 2, then Euler's formula tells me that this is twice v rho. So actually, V rho is some multiple of rho hat times rho. And so this volume is really, if you like, the imaginary part of big omega wedge omega bar. It is the usual sort of holomorphic volume. Oh, yeah. Sure. No. So that's right. The hat depends on rho. Yes, I mean, it's a nonlinear expression in terms of rho. Right, so now we can, so this volume, so in the case of a manifold, so what you could say is that rho, in the case up there, determines this complex three form. So what it gives you is an almost complex structure on M, and it's a three zero form. There's no integrability yet, this is just linear algebra. Then what we're looking at here is essentially the integral of omega wedge omega bar. It's that volume. But as I say, I want to use this in a different context later on, so I want to keep this formula. Right, so it's this volume is what we're going to use in order to get to a Calabi-Yau manifold from the cohomology class. So what we do is that you take a cohomology class, a real cohomology class, say A, and you look for forms which are contained in this cohomology class. So you look for closed forms such that the Durham cohomology class of rho is equal to A, and also such that rho is at each point is in this open set. Now you might ask, you know, can I always find such a thing? Well, it's not hard to see that actually, once you've got the topological constraint that there exists one such form, you can usually find closed forms with that property. Okay, so we're going to look then at the forms within this cohomology class, which are what are called stable, and we're going to look at this function, this volume, on those forms. And then we're going to look at the critical points of that volume. So we look at the volume functional restricted to this cohomology class. And you look for critical points. So we write it. So we look for critical points of V restricted to A, this cohomology class. So this is like Hodge theory, really. If this V was the L2 norm squared of the relative to a metric, then the critical points will give us the harmonic forms. So we'd be trying to find a distinguished class within this a distinguished form within this cohomology class. And this is the same sort of thing, except it's a different functional. So this is the way we're trying to go, as I say, back from a cohomology class to a Calabi-Yau manifold. And the answer is that you try and do this by looking at these critical points. Because what are the critical points? There, I look at the first variation of this. And I vary within the cohomology class. So rho dot is now an exact form, because I'm only varying rho within the cohomology class, so I can change it infinitesimally by an exact form. And what does the formula say? This is so this is the derivative of phi evaluated on rho dot, first variation. On the other hand, that was rho hat, where's rho dot? But rho dot is d xi, so that's the integral of rho hat, where's d xi. And now, by Stokes' theorem, this is it's an odd form. I think the sign is this, d rho hat wedge psi. And so if that's equal to 0 for all exact forms, then d rho hat is equal to 0. So the critical points correspond to the situation where d rho hat is equal to 0, as well as d rho is equal to 0. So that says that d of omega is equal to 0, And that actually is the condition for integrability. So the almost complex structure implies that this is some simple argument to say that that is actually integrability of the almost complex structure. So from this point of view, it's the we get from a cohomology class via this volume functional to a Calabi-Yau. I mean, if you can find, you know, a Calabi-Yau complex structure within there. So that's really what started me off on this. Now, one of the things which... Sorry? Yeah. So, well, my open set is always... I'm always assuming that I have a row within this open set. I mean, once row is there, then row hat is also in there. Yeah?
Clearly, E row hat equals 0 will be a critical point. Is it possible to have other critical points? Just E row hat wedge of psi?
Well, this has got to be equal to 0 for all psi, because we're varying over all exact forms.
All psi. Okay.
Okay, so one of the features about this is that it gives you another approach to the moduli problem, in this particular dimension. And so I just want to talk about that briefly, because when I go on to the generalized complex structure picture, then it'll be certain features of it will suggest what a moduli space for generalized complex structures should really be. So what we've got here then is that we try and characterize Calabi-Yau structures as critical points of this functional restricted to a cohomology class. So the picture is this. So as an analogy, let me think of a function of two variables. So I think, let me think of T as being a parameter, like, if you like, T varying over the cohomology group, H3, and X, say, being something like the forms. Anyway, I want to consider, first of all, the finite dimensional analog. We have a parameterized family of functions, and we want to consider whether near a critical point with respect to X, whether there are other nearby critical points. So what do you do? You think of, so suppose that this is a mapping, Rn cross Rk, or an open set into the reals. Then if we look at the derivative of this, so the derivative in the direction X of F, this will be a map from Rn cross Rk to Rn. And if we're looking for critical points, we're looking for the zeros of this function. So if the derivative of this map in the x direction, in other words, if the Hessian of f in the x directions is non-degenerate, then that implies that the derivative of this map is surjective, so the implicit function theorem will say that if you have a critical point for t is equal to t0, then there's a unique critical point for nearby t. Okay, so then you get critical points, in fact, unique ones for all t in some open set containing t0. So there's a k. This is a k. Well, so this is the derivative of this function in the x direction. So this is an Rn. So I'm just thinking of a parameterized function, and then thinking of the critical points. And I'm just saying that the Hessian, the non-degeneracy of the Hessian, is what's needed to say that there's a given a critical point at if it's the Hessian is non-degenerate, it's an isolated critical point, then if we vary t, then there'll be a critical point for each t suitably close. Okay, so this is what we want to do. We want to say, suppose I, in order to construct a moduli space, we want to say, suppose I have one Calabi-Yau determined by a particular cohomology class. I would like to say that a nearby cohomology class also has another Calabi-Yau associated to it. So this is the sort of finite dimensional model for what I want. Now, of course, in this case, the Hessian is not non-degenerate because we have diffeomorphism invariance. Okay, so diffeomorphism invariance, okay, implies that this function v is actually constant on the orbits, on these diff m orbits. So we're not at these critical points will never be isolated. The Hessian will never be non-degenerate. But on the other hand, we're after a moduli space picture. So roughly speaking, what we would like is to say that if we look at the quotient by the group of the diffeomorphisms, then we want to have a non-degenerate Hessian. Now, a better way of saying that is to say that you want to know that if the Hessian is non-degenerate transverse to these orbits, or if it's what's called a Morse bot to the orbits, so this is usually called a Morse bot singularity, Morse bot critical point. Then that will imply that basically the moduli space, the quotient, is in one-to-one correspondence with the parameters. Now, I mean, I'm saying this in a very vague way, but what I should say is that actually the usual techniques, if you like, of Banach space implicit function theorems and elliptic estimates actually give that H3MR is a local moduli space. I don't really want to dwell on this very much. The only point that I want to make is that we have this diffeomorphism invariance, and it's important to know that the Hessian is non-degenerate in this transverse direction. Is it, in the Calabi-Yau situation, is it always non-degenerate? And the answer is that it certainly is if the DD bar lemma holds. Now, so what I called Calabi-Yau manifolds here were really just complex manifolds with trivial canonical bundle, and of course, if you impose the condition of Kähler, then you always have the DD bar lemma. There are some other ones associated with the connected sums of S3 cross S3 with certain complex structures. They also satisfy the DD bar lemma. So this picture actually extends to more than Kähler manifolds. Exactly, that's right. So you're at it. So this is only a local moduli space. So in other words, so you're at a critical point. It has a complex structure. If the DD bar lemma holds, then that is a non-degenerate critical point. Oh gosh, I don't know. I don't know so much about it. Is this an open condition, DD bar lemma? I'm not quite sure about that, actually. Yeah?
The Banach space technique
works with the well, it depends what you're trying to produce. That's right. So, I mean, I'm not strictly speaking talking about a quotient. I'm producing a manifold which will have a complex structure which is isomorphic to the Kuranishi space, if you like. So. I mean, I agree with you that there are. I mean, it's essentially producing some finite dimensional space which The universality of the current issue space sort of tells you that this is the right one. Yeah, I mean, it's of course, it's not gauge theory, it's different morphism groups, it's slightly different. Oh yeah, sure. This is just a local moduli space. Yeah, that's right. Well, around each, if you like, you know, the moduli space is locally modeled on H3. Yeah. So, I mean, there are other issues about global Torelli theorems and so on, which I'm not dealing with here. This is just a local question at the moment. Okay, so the point I wanted to make here was that this formalism actually gives you a means of getting at the moduli space in this particular dimension, and that we encounter this question of diffeomorphism invariance and non-degeneracy of the Hessian in order to get the cohomology class of the three form, giving us the local modulus. Now, I mean, I wrote a couple of papers on this, which also talked about the special Kähler structure on the moduli space and so on. But I want to now just go back to the origins of this. So let me. Yeah, I don't know enough about complex manifolds with trivial canonical bundles about whether there are ones which don't satisfy the DD bar lemma. I mean, maybe somebody can.
Even dimensional compact Lie groups with the invariant complex structure.
Ah, okay. They don't okay. And they have trivial.
They have trivial canonical bundles.
Okay. Okay. So this is a definite restriction. Yes. Oh.
Compact ones with the compact
spheres. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So these are like nilpotent. I mean, nil manifolds. That's what I mean.
Yeah. Nil manifolds, but then you have quotient.
I mean, typically, actually, you'll meet this again. But typically, you know, failure of these types of lemmas tend, you know, the examples tend to be nil type objects. Nil manifolds, quotients of certain groups. Anyway, you need a condition, and that's the non-degeneracy condition in this case. Okay, so where did I start from? I started from a fact in linear algebra that, if you like, the real part of the complex 3-0 form is somehow general, lies inside an open set. So, this is a more general setting for this. You can suppose you have a Lie group G, and you have some vector space V, some representation space. Then you can ask, does it have open orbits? So if you have a case where, well, if you work over the, depends what field you work over, but basically if there are open orbits, then this is called a pre-homogeneous vector space. I didn't know this until recently, but there's quite a literature on it. So what I talked about here about three forms is basically classical. I think I chased it up to the late 19th century. And there are a lot of sporadic cases where you can consider you find these pre-homogeneous vector spaces, and you can find them mentioned in Cartan, in various geometrical papers in the 1930s, 1920s, and so on. But there is actually a systematic classification of these, so by Sato and Kimura. Well, you impose some conditions on the group, but they give a classification of these pre-homogeneous vector spaces. So this is in the Nagoya Journal in 1977. And it's a long paper, but you know, it's not a paper to read, it's a paper to look at the lists. and to think of geometry associated with each one of these. So it's a challenging problem, really, because somehow these are all very special. These are like the sort of special isomorphisms in low-dimensional Lie groups. You know, each one of those has something to say about geometry. So you look down the list, and sure enough, you find GL6R acting on the three forms, the sort of thing we've been looking at here. But there are lots of other ones as well, but not too many. And there's one in particular which, so this is the way I got into things, but so there was another one which I was interested in, which is spin 6-6 cross R star acting on either of its spin representations. So this is just scalar multiplication. So we're acting on the spin, you know, the spin representation, which we've already seen, of course. I mean, what spin 6-6 is, the spin representation is really given by the exterior algebra. This is, think of a T plus T star. Our T plus T star had this, in six dimensions, had this orthogonal structure, this 066 structure, and the spinners were given by the exterior algebra of R6. So in this case, it's, well, we're looking at one of the half spin representations, so we can think of this as the even exterior algebra of, even part of the exterior algebra of R6. So what's the dimension of this? This is a half of 2 to the 6th, which is equal to 32. Right? Yeah. So the statement is that actually this, where have I got to? That this vector space has an open orbit under this group. So this is the usual spin representation, and this is scalar multiplication. So what is the dimension of the stabilizer? Well, what is its dimension? The dimension is, so the dimension of this group is 1 plus 12 times 11 over 2, which is equal to, so we've got that, minus, where are we? Yeah, 32. So this is 67 minus 32, which is, no, what am I talking about? 35, thank you. That's the dimension. And well, there are actually different open orbits over the reals. There's a one over the complex numbers, but there's a particular one where the stabilizer is SU33. And this, of course, is the, if we think of SU33 sitting inside 066, this is the structure that we've been thinking about in terms of generalized Calabi-Yau manifolds. So we basically, we can go through what I was doing before, but let's look at the linear algebra first. So the situation here is that there's an open set. So let's just take, choose either even or odd. There's a different, well, it's the same, essentially the same story as far as this is concerned, but in terms of applications, it's a slightly different story. So we can look at we look at this open orbit inside here, and well, what happens is that it's analogous to the Calabi-Yau situation. So what happens is that actually, this is a proposition, that rho is the real part of a pure spinner. Remember those? A pure spinner phi with phi phi bar not equal to zero. So these this open set of forms now, forms of mixed degree, which we, so I'm going to put even odd, so because it's the same thing goes for either, then actually rho is the real part of a pure spinner. So just analogous to the situation we had with the Calabi-Yaus, that the real part of a complex 3-0 form is actually generic, or at least it lies in an open set. The same happens here in these dimensions, that when we look at a pure spinner, so a pure spinner satisfies these algebraic conditions, but this is a complex pure spinner, then actually the real part lies in an open set, or any point in this open set is the real part of one of these. So this is a direct analog of what happened in the case of three forms in six dimensions. So we can go through this whole picture, this whole variational picture in the same way. Okay, so we do the same thing. That is, that you see from a form row in this particular open set, we get a pure spinner phi, and we associate to that I times the. So we use the Mokai pairing here to get something which is in the top exterior power. Okay, now. Which six of these star. Now, here I was being. So why is it in here? Well, in a sense, we have to remember that the spin representation is not really quite the exterior powers. You have to twist by this square root. So this thing is a real-valued function on the actual spin representation. But when we're representing spinners by forms, then we have to untwist that square root. This is still quadratic, so actually it takes its value in this top degree part here. But anyway, this gives us a volume functional, just as before. It gives us a phi, of rho, as a map from now the open set in the mixed degree into top degree. And we can go through everything that I've said before. In other words, you associate to rho another one, rho hat, where rho hat is a nonlinear expression in rho. And what is rho hat? Well, rho hat is the imaginary part of the pure spinner. So the picture is really just the same as the Calabi-Yau situation. In fact, the Calabi-Yau situation is a special case of this because GL6 sits inside spin 6-6, and a holomorphic 3 form or a 3-0 form is actually a special case of a pure spinner. But you go through the whole picture, and then you ask for critical points of the functional on a cohomology class. In this case, the cohomology class is a mixed degree. And so what do we get? Well, the critical points on a cohomology class correspond to where d rho hat is equal to 0. So that's the same as d phi is equal to 0. And if you go back to my definition of a generalized Calabi-Yau manifold, that is precisely what it is. So this is a generalized Calabi-Yau manifold. So you see, I mean, I didn't really have to think up what a generalized Calabi-Yau manifold really was. All I had to do was to recognize that this group and its action had a geometrical interpretation and then turn the handle. So that, in fact, is where this idea came from. And then there's another question about trying to identify this condition in other terms. So using the generalized complex structure, the Courant bracket is another issue. But this critical point approach gives us this notion. And you can approach this in the same way. You can now say, well, let's try and show that the moduli space of these structures is the local moduli space is an open set in the cohomology, either the even cohomology or the odd cohomology, depending on which whether your form is even or odd. And indeed, this works so long as all of these conditions work here. So what you find is that if you only use the diffeomorphism group, then the Hessian is actually still degenerate. So this is where the B field comes in here. And of course, it's, as we know, with hindsight, closed two forms acting as B fields preserve the orthogonal structure, and in particular, through the spin action, they preserve this this volume functional here. So we could we already know that the diffeomorphism group is this volume function is invariant under the diffeomorphism group, but we also know that it's invariant under a B field. On the other hand, what are we trying to do? We're trying to take a form rho, which is closed, and lies in a fixed cohomology class. So, you choose even or odd. I mean, there are two different types of these. So there, I haven't given you yet so many examples. Maybe the next time I'll give you examples of even and odd structures. So strictly speaking, the group of equivalences you need are the ones which preserve this cohomology class. So I suppose essentially you've got to look at the diffeomorphisms connected to the identity. And now, well, you have to look at the exact two forms, B fields, which are exact two forms, in order to preserve this cohomology class. Okay, so if I multiply rho by e to the d xi, then the cohomology class of that is equal to the cohomology class of rho. Okay. So if I take an arbitrary closed two form as a B field, then I'll tend to shift this cohomology class. So the variational problem doesn't make sense unless you restrict yourself to these exact B fields. And what you find then is that you look at the Hessian of this functional, and sure enough, under suitable conditions, it is non-degenerate transverse to this orbit. But the orbit of this bigger group now, not just the diffeomorphism group, but this bigger group. Well, under certain circumstances. So there's a condition. There's a condition which I call I don't want to tell you what it is. If the DDJ lemma holds, so this is a natural statement for these generalized Kilabi-Yau manifolds, then the Hessian is non-degenerate transverse to this action, and then this gives us a local moduli space, which is so now we have to think of a local moduli space, I modulo the action not just of diffeomorphisms but of diffeomorphisms in exact B fields, so that's the natural notion of equivalence here, which is isomorphic to some open set in the cohomology, even or odd, depending on what you start with. So this is, a generalization of the Kalabi-Yau situation. You get mixed degree cohomology parametrizing these structures. Now, it's quite interesting that this how this specializes, this DDJ lemma. So in the case of a symplectic manifold, I'm not saying that it's equivalent to, but the strong Lefschetz theorem implies it. So this is only on a sixth manifold, so the strong Lefschetz theorem, for those of you who don't know it, says that if you take the Kähler class, or the two for the symplectic class, then this is the only bit that we're interested in, then its wedge product with H2 up to HM4 is an isomorphism. So this is true for a Kähler manifold, for example. So we have these two extremes. So remember that generalized Kalabi-Yau manifolds include symplectic manifolds and ordinary Kalabi-Yau manifolds. And in the symplectic case, this DDJ lemma, DDJ lemma is essentially equivalent to the Strong-Lifshitz formula. And in the complex case, it's the ordinary DD bar lemma. So it's a condition which, in these particular dimensions at least, somehow interpolates between Strong-Lifshitz and the DD bar condition. Okay, so that's the way in which I found this notion of generalized Calabi-Yau, and it was really by analogy with the ordinary Calabi-Yau in six real dimensions. But in a sense, it was based on this property of orbits, open orbits. So now if you go back to the lists, then you find some other interesting cases. So in the last half hour, I want to say something about the other types of geometries which appear. Well, there's one which is well known. So another of these open orbit questions is where you take the general linear group in seven dimensions, acting again on the three forms. So in this case, the dimensions are, so what is this? This is 49 dimensional, so the stabilizer is 49 minus, this is 7 times 6 times 5 over 1 times 2 times 3, so that's equal to 14. And what is that stabilizer? Well, again, there are different open sets, but basically it's the group G2. So if I take a generic three-form, or a three-form in the open set determined by this open orbit in three dimensions, then its stabilizer in GL7R is G2. So again, we have the same situation. We have a volume. I mean, so the volume here is just equal to the metric volume. So G2, the group G2, is compact, preserves a metric, and so there is a metric volume associated to the three-form row. So this is just the metric volume form. And so in this case, we have row, our three-form on the seven-manifold, so it determines a volume, and we have correspondingly a dual form, which in this case is a the star is determined by rho. So the three form is rho. It determines a metric itself. So I take the Hodge star relative to that. So this rho hat is actually now star rho, but star is the star depending on the metric determined by rho. Okay. So maybe I'm jumping. So rho hat. I mean, again, I get this. So I, if you like, I start here. Okay, V is the metric volume. So, I start with my three-fold. It has a stabilizer, the group G2. What does G2 preserve? It preserves the three-fold, but in particular, it also preserves a metric. That metric has a volume form.
G2 preserves the metric on V-star.
On R7. V here is R7. Or whatever. So I'm just thinking of G2. Sitting inside the general linear group, GL7. Now, of course, you might say, well, I mean, can I choose? I mean, there's a choice, if you like. I mean, G2 preserves a metric and twice that metric and half that metric. There's a uniform choice to make, but it's the same sort of thing as if I ask you, what is the volume form for a symplectic manifold? Are you going to tell me omega to the n or omega to the n over n factorial? You know, there's a choice. But once you've made that choice, it goes through. That's right. But I mean, you choose it once and for all, and then you get the volume.
So I get a volume, which gives me a, if you like, a function of rho with values in the volume forms. The derivative of this is given by wedging with a 4 form. And what is that dual 4 form? It's the Hodge-Star operator of the metric which we use, which rho defines, applied to rho. And then the critical points are where d rho hat is equal to d rho is equal to 0. And that, and it's known that that is equivalent to a G2 holonomy structure. In other words, if rho is harmonic relative to the metric which it determines itself, then there's an argument many years ago, Alfred Gray, I think, which shows that actually this is a G2 holonomy manifold. So, yes, exactly. This is all very nonlinear. Okay, well, in this case, you can work out the homogeneity. Well, here, if you want to know the homogeneity of this, well, it's... not here. Actually, so in this case, the moduli space is an open set in H3, as before, but there's no complex structure on this. So it has a metric on it, a sort of Hessian-type metric, but I don't know of any holomorphic prepotential to associate to it. Somehow there's no special Kähler metric on that moduli space. Well, okay, so now if you look, what you find is that in the list, in Sato and Kimura's list, you also find spin 7, 7 across R star. So it's analogous to this. So this also has an open orbit. So this is now on the spin representation in 7 dimensions. So this is a 64-dimensional representation. And again, so now you have to ask, what is the stabilizer? Well, first of all, what's the dimension? So the dimension here we've got 14 times 13 over 2 plus 1. Minus 64. So this is 92 minus 64, which is 28. And the stabilizer in this case is there are different choices again, but one of them is G2 cross G2. So this is, now in this case, if you really want to know what this the algebraic form of this volume functional, it's terribly complicated. There's a Japanese paper that I have, which gives the formula, but it's not at all useful. So that's why it's much better to use these general procedures here. So what do we got here? So here we have a new structure somehow coming out of this, but we have the same sort of thing. So we now have a rho. Again, we think of the spin representation as being given by forms. Well, this is, in this case, you could choose even or odd, but I mean they're both equivalent. So let's suppose that rho is an even form in 7 dimensions. Then we have rho hat is an odd form. And we have the same structure so that we can look at critical points and so on and so forth. So the critical points correspond to this, and this is some geometrical structure whose moduli space, at least if we know, if we can calculate the Hessian. So this is work that's being done by my student Frederick Witt at the moment. If you know the non-degeneracy condition for the Hessian, then there'll be some moduli space of these structures. Modulo diffeomorphisms and exact B fields, which will be parameterized by an open set in the odd cohomology, or equivalently the even cohomology of a 7 manifold. So again, instead of in the pure G2 structure case, taking the cohomology class as a 3 form or the 4 form, in this case we get all degrees. So, you know, this is a structure which has this property, but of course, what we really need to know is what it, another way of saying it. I mean, this is convenient. Yeah, so it's still got B-field symmetry because it's coming from spin 7-7 and the B-field is part of that action. So the volume form is invariant under spin 7-7, so in particular under the B-field action, and if we restrict to exact B-fields, then we're preserving cohomology classes and so on. So when you look at the moduli space, you have to look at the moduli space, not just modulo diffeomorphisms, but modulo exact B field. Yeah, that's a good point. It turns out to be non-degenerate. I mean, in other words. The volume form is, but on the other hand, if I take a 2 tensor, that's going to mess up closeness of forms, not just the cohomology class, but it's going to mess up the closeness. So I mean, I can act on one of these spinners or forms, if you like, by a 2 tensor instead of a 2 form, but it's going to map a closed form into something which is non-closed in general. So. The GL6 really is coming from. The diffeomorphism group is effectively the GL6. I mean, of course, it moves point to point, but it's that invariance which is diffeomorphism invariance. It's the two-form invariance is sort of related to the fact that we're looking at a problem involving closed forms, and then we can apply a closed two-form to this. If you want to fix the cohomology class, it has to be exact two-form. But the other part of spin 6-6, the two tensors, are going to mess up everything. Maybe there's a parallel version of this which does that, but it's not going to involve cohomology. So let me try. So this, the G2 cross G2 case is.
In all these cases, there was a special open orbit that had this nice stabilizer.
Yeah.
Is it unique?
There are other orbits which have different.
Is it unique with this stabilizer?
Oh, gosh. Okay, I mean, I'm not quite sure because sometimes there are components here. Sometimes there are orientation questions. Usually it's a question of orientations and connectedness and so on. I quite agree there may be other ones. In fact, it's, yes. So in fact, in the, quite right, yeah. Well, I want to go into that. In fact, there's another orbit which is the complexification of G2 as well. So if you look at the complex group G2C is also a stabilizer. Yeah. And at first I thought that this was, so this is going to, if you use that other orbit, then you're going to get a complex structure on T plus T star. But it's not one of these generalized complex structures. It's compatible with a metric of, well, the metric becomes of type 2.0 plus 0.2 rather than 1.1. You know, it's like a complexification of a real metric. There may be some story related to that as well, but somehow I prefer to look at the compact case first. What does this G2 cross G2 structure really mean? So it's a picture which I drew yesterday, I think. But here we have the tangent bundle plus the cotangent bundle. And when I say I have a G2 cross G2 structure, I don't mean that there's a G2 structure here and a G2 structure here, because these are isotropic subspaces. So what it means is that there are, as before, there's a subspace V and its orthogonal subspace V perpendicular, and that I have, in that case, the projection onto T is an isomorphism, so I have an induced metric on this, which becomes a metric on T, and in fact, there's a metric on T star, which is the opposite, there's another way around. There's a metric on V minus, V perpendicular, which is minus the metric on this. So we can identify either of these, okay, so we can identify V perp with T, and V with T. The induced metric on V becomes a metric on T. The induced metric on this becomes minus that metric on T. So whatever this G2 cross G2 structure does is to give a metric. And then on this V, I have one G2 structure. And on this, I have another one. So I have two, if you like, I better say almost G2 structures, I suppose, but compatible with the same metric. And then, essentially, I also have a B field, if you like. So. No. So the metric, this is positive. Well, you can choose. I mean, with this G2, this is a positive definite metric. So on V plus V perp, it's the standard metric of signature 7-7, but it's composed this way. So V plus V perp is the same as T plus T star, but it's positive definite on this and negative definite on this. So this is a picture that you have a metric, two G2 structures, and a B field. And if you count these parameters, you get the same as the form. So something which satisfies these conditions consists of this data, a metric, two almost G2 structures in a B field, and, you know, so those are integrability conditions, which we haven't yet figured out, I have to say. Sorry? It depends where you're starting from. Here, it's convenient to, I mean, if I start from rho, I get this structure, but now I'm expressing it in a slightly different way. That given a metric, I mean, what is a G2 structure? A G2 is the stabilizer of a spinner. So, if you like, I have two spinners, two unit spinners, non-zero. Not covariantly constant, no. So I haven't said, you see, the question is, what is the integrability condition? And that is, what does this imply? And that we don't know yet. But from the pure sort of structure group situation, this is what we have. Maybe it makes... So two G2 structures, I can think of those as having... Maybe it's better to say this. I have a metric. This is equivalent to two spinners, two non-zero spinners. Because... A reduction to G2. Maybe it's better to call that. I have an orthogonal structure on the tangent bundle. A reduction to G2 is given by the choice of a non-vanishing spinner, a unit spinner, shall we say. But I have two of these. And that gives me two different reductions to G2. I also have a B field. So this is the way. So the way in which you get the form is really the following. So now. What is a form? I said a form was a spinner for T plus T star, but now that we've decomposed T plus T star into the direct sum of a positive definite and a negative definite one, then we can describe spinners in another way. If you like, the spinners corresponding to V, tensor the spinners corresponding to V perpendicular, this is equal to the spinners for T plus T star, which is also the same as the even or the odd exterior algebra. So it's convenient for one purpose to think of spinners for T plus T star as being forms, but now you can also think of them as being tensor products of spinners, because it's a vector space and the direct sum of something positive, definite, and negative definite. So what you do, so let's call these two spinners phi plus and phi minus. So you look at phi plus tensor phi minus. So this is the one which is stabilized by one G2 structure, this stabilized by the other. This gives you a form, but you also multiply it by a B field. So that is the way in which you get the form rho, the real form rho, out of this property.
And the statement is, we can go back. If we have a rho, we can always decompose it.
Yeah, so if rho is in this open set, yeah. So it's slightly mysterious. So you might say, well, are there any examples? And of course, the obvious example is a usual G2 structure. So if I take an ordinary G2 manifold, a G2 holonomy manifold, so that's like taking, if you like, phi plus equal to phi minus. This is the stabilizer, this is the covariant constant form which stabilizes. And suppose I'm running out of notation. Suppose big phi, suppose this is the 3 form, the covariant constant 3 form. Yeah? Okay, this is when I say a G2 holonomy, okay. What I'm saying is, suppose I take two of these two G2 structures to be the same, and suppose it's an integrable, suppose it's a G2 holonomy one. Then I just want to show that it's a particular case of this. So, yeah, there's a 3 form, because when you take the tensor product of these two spinners, I'll just write it down. So rho in this case is equal to 1 minus, so the even one is this, and then rho hat is the constant times minus this plus the volume. So what I'm saying is, actually, if you take the phi plus to be equal to phi minus, and b equal to be 0, then if you expand this in as a form, what you get is this. So this is the 4 form, which is invariant under the G2 structure. This is the 3 form. So this is the even form, and this is the odd form. And of course, if phi is, and you see that this is closed, okay? I mean, rho and rho hat are closed. So these conditions are certainly satisfied. And of course there's an obvious second example, which is a B field transform. Which is just like saying we take a closed 2 form and then we look at e to the B times this. And that, of course, actually fills out all of the cohomology. So if you look at e to the B times the, times 1 minus star phi, if you look at the cohomology class of that, then if you vary through all closed 2 forms B, then you get all nearby cohomology classes in the even case. So it's conceivable. I mean, we haven't done the actual deformation theory in this case, the moduli space theory in this case, but it's conceivable that near a pure G2 holonomy manifold, the nearby generalized G2 structures will all be B-field transforms of this one. So that's the situation, for example, that occurs in symplectic geometry. If you have a symplectic manifold, think of it as a generalized complex manifold, then nearby generalized complex structures are B-field transforms of a symplectic manifold. Sorry? B is just a 2 form. So I mean, all of this structure is invariant under closed 2 form. So if you give me any example, I can always transform it by a closed 2 form and get another example. But that will give us different cohomology classes. So you might say, are there any others? And I don't know. On the other hand, there is one interesting invariant here. There's actually an integer invariant for this structure, which is 0 in this particular case. So the interesting question is whether there are integrable, in that sense, structures. So what is this integer invariant? So what do I say? So suppose we have a 7 manifold. This is just a topological invariant. If I have a 7 manifold, I take the spin bundle over this, so the spin bundle is a real 8-dimensional manifold, and I take the unit sphere bundle inside that. Okay. Then what is a reduction to G2? It's given by a section sigma of this, right? It's given by a choice of a unit spinner, non-vanishing, yeah, unit spinner. But what is so? What is U S? This is a 14-dimensional manifold. And if I have two sections, then I have two oriented 7-dimensional submanifolds. So I can take the cut product, the intersection number, if you like, Poincaré dual of one section with a Poincaré dual of the other. And of course, while the the intersection form is skew symmetric in this dimension, so this is equal. So this is plus or minus some integer n. And if sigma plus is equal to sigma minus, then because it's skew, n is equal to zero. So what I'm saying now is that if you like reductions to G2 cross G2 in this sense, topologically, have associated to them an integer. And so the interesting question is, if that integer is non-zero, so what do the integers say? No. I'm saying that there is some equation which relates them, which might be related to covariantly constant with a connection with torsion or something like that. I mean, tomorrow I'll talk about something similar in the complex case where you really get connections with skewed torsion. But in this case, we don't yet know what the situation is, but it's quite conceivable that there is some connection with torsion for which these two things are. But I don't think it's going to be skew symmetric torsion, if that's a problem. So this number n, it really counts the number of points where these two coincide. Right? So you have these two G2 structures, and there are a certain number of points where they coincide. So there's a lot to be learned, I think, about these structures. But I mean, in a sense, what I wanted to do was just to show you that this variational approach, this idea of going from the cohomology class up to the structure, it yields, in a natural way, some other structures which we might not have thought of otherwise. Let me just finish by pointing out that there is actually an integer invariant, not just for this G2 case, but actually for the case we've been thinking of before. If I look at in six real dimensions, suppose I look at a generalized complex manifold in six real dimensions. Well, there's something special about six dimensions in all of this. So suppose I look at what I was doing there. So if we think of, if you remember, what I said was that U33, you know, was homotopy equivalent to U3 cross U3. And so essentially, as far as topology is concerned, we have two different complex structures, the same metric and two different complex structures. This is analogous to this G2 picture. There we have one metric and two G2 structures. Here we have one metric and two complex structures. Now, in this case, so what is the space of complex structures? It's SO6 over U3 at each point. And this is well known. This is the twister space. This is CP3. So it's really the projectivized spin bundle. So the spin bundle in six dimensions is complex four-dimensional bundle. So we have this. So in this case, a complex structure is a section of this projective bundle here. So if we have two of these, then again you can look at the intersection form. Intersection number, the Poincaré dual of these two sections. And again, it measures the number of points at which these coincide. So that's an integer. In this case, it's you've got a 12-dimensional manifold, so it's a symmetric intersection form. So this is some number, some integer, well-defined. Not up to sign. So what is it? Well, it relates to the first Chern class of that canonical bundle I talked about yesterday. So so remember that there's this line bundle L on a generalized complex manifold which carries the pure spinners which define the isotropic subbundle. So if I take the first Chern class of that to be L, then if my calculation is correct, then this number here, call it N, is equal to L cubed minus C1 L squared plus C2 L minus C3. And now you might ask, okay, I have to choose a complex structure. It looks at first sight as if you have to choose one of the complex structures, but it turns out that you don't, because, well, exercise if you like, but suppose I do this. Well, first of all, this is equal to this because it's the Euler characteristic, right? So if I look at the difference, so n plus minus n minus is equal to L squared into C1 plus minus C1 minus. Sorry, wrong sign, isn't it? Minus that. Plus L into C2 plus minus C2 minus. But again, C2 is given by the first Pontryagin class and some of the square of the first Chern class. So I think if I've got the signs right, this is something like C plus 1 squared over 2 minus C1 minus squared over 2. And I calculated yesterday that this L is C1 plus C1 minus over 2. So if I've got my signs right, that should actually be equal to 0. So in fact, this number is independent of which complex structure you use. So this is the analogous invariant for a generalized complex structure. But is this interesting? Well, in the case of generalized Calabi-Yau, L is equal to 0. We have a global trivialization of this line bundle. And then this number is just the Euler characteristic. So in fact, for generalized Calabi-Yau manifolds, we don't have this integer invariant. Well, we have one, but it's just the topological invariant of the structure. But in this G2 cross G2 case, it's a sort of extra invariant. OK, well, this, I hope, indicates that there are other structures lying around which are still compatible with B fields and equivalently, and in special cases, arise in this natural way. And in particular, what we've just encountered is G2 cross G2. So tomorrow, I want to talk about what you could call structures of not just UNN, but UN cross UN. This is essentially the idea of bringing in a metric to play, a metric which is compatible with a generalized complex structure. And these things are called generalized Kähler manifolds. So I'll show tomorrow how these have a natural formalism within the notion of generalized complex manifolds in general, and how they relate to certain very concrete differential geometric problems. Okay. Yeah, there is. I mean, spin 7 doesn't appear in the open orbit picture, but it's closely connected to it. No, the four form, the invariant four form for spin 7 is a special one. It's not a. If you perturb it slightly, it's no longer a spin 7 form. But on the other hand, it is definitely true that, if you like, the action of spin 8, there's an action of spin 8 cross R star on spinners. There are points whose stabilizer is spin 7 cross spin 7. So there's certainly a spin 7 cross spin 7 picture. But there are also other things. I mean, we don't have to use that open orbit picture. There are, for example, SPN cross SPN. This is, I mean, I haven't talked about quaternionic or hyperkähler analogs, but there's we're looking at basically, things that fix lots of spinners, but spinners for T plus T star rather than spinners for SON.
Do you understand the relation between generalized Calabi-Yau structures and string transportation? I don't know if it's a fact. On the other hand, I see a lot of analogs to Ramon's own field.
generalization of the magnification field. We don't have a Coulombian element, but we have a Coulombian element with a B field.
Well, if you're seeing connections, I'm very happy, but I'm not sure that I can answer the question. I mean,
the closest thing I've thought to generalize, you know, other string classifications is when you said that there would be an analog covariant constant center.
Yeah.
But covariant constant plus some Clifford bulk, not sure.
Yeah.
That's, of course, what you get in supergravity.
Yeah. Well, so what? So tomorrow I'll talk about this case where actually the geometry you describe is that you have a metric, you have two complex structures, integrable complex structures, such that the metric is Hermitian relative to those. You have therefore two connections which preserve the complex structure and the metric. Those connections have skew symmetric torsion, which is of the form D of a 2 form, and the average of those is the Levi-Civita connection. Okay. So that kind of connection has a very easy. Well, we don't have. Well, what do we have? We only have UN cross UN structure. So, the connections have holonomy group UN. So, I mean, that's everything. The only thing that they preserve are the things which are invariant under UN. But you could restrict it to SUN cross SUN and get other things. So there's. What I would say, I hope to show this tomorrow, is that within this. Formalism or this language of generalized structures, there is a very natural way. Well, I can tell you what it is. It's a pair of generalized complex structures which commute. That is totally equivalent to this. So when you have an ordinary Kähler structure, so a symplectic structure gives you one generalized complex structure, a complex structure gives you another. If they commute, then that's the compatibility for a Kähler metric. Symplectic form is of type 1-1. If you then approach the more general question, suppose I have any two generalized complex structures that commute, then this is the bit. You don't get Kähler manifolds, but you get this type of manifold. So that is the, as I understand this. Though interestingly enough, we always have an exact. I mean, the skew symmetric torsion is always exact in this case. I don't know of a way of formalizing it where we have a non-exact one.
Other questions? How large is the
capital? It depends. I mean, they have a. First of all, you start with the reductive group, and then you look at ones where there are invariants, and sometimes there aren't invariants. So, in the case where I've been looking at a product with a scalar, then if you remove the scalar, then basically you've got a codimension one orbit. So you're talking about invariants. I mean, there are different categories of these things, but the paper's very long, but the list is only. 15 pages or so at the end. But don't get me wrong, a lot of them are repetitions. You can get one of these groups and then you can take the product with another group. If you really want to restrict yourself to semi-simple groups, then it's a very short list. Yeah. There's an interesting one actually. I think E7 is a nice one. There's a non-compact form of E7 which has an open orbit. And I thought about that a bit. I have no idea how to incorporate that into this picture.
Other questions? Okay, let's thank Nigel again.
So now 100.